Well, hello again, everybody. We are back for Classic Movies number 28. I hope I've got somebody in the chat to say that I can see it on the screen there. And this is a bit of a special one, actually, because we finally got the Duke himself on Classic Movies. It's the first ever John Wayne appearance on Classic Movies. I'm sure it's not going to be the last one, but it is a big moment. We've got the legend that is John Wayne, not in a personal way, but one of his top movies anyway. Also, I should say, I've got a bit of a cold. I've got like this weird summer head cold thing, so I may sniffle and I may sound a little bit off, but that's what it is. I mean, there's dark rumors about flus and things coming around this time of year, but none of that matters. None of that matters here on Classic Movies. We're going to shut all of the misery of the world out and enjoy a deliberately cozy 90 minutes or so, having a look at a Hollywood classic. So Endeavour is here once again. How are we doing, Endeavour?
I'm doing great. I'm glad we finally got around to doing this one. I think we had been talking about doing True Grit since we had started this series. So yeah, it should be a good one. And we finally got around to a John Wayne.
Yeah, I mean, it was long overdue to do a John Wayne one, to be honest. But a few people said that you should do The Shootist, that they thought The Shootist, which was his final movie, is the best one. And I think all in all, I probably do, as a film, I think The Shootist is probably a better sort of film in itself. But I think one of the things I love about True Grit is that it reminds me, and this is what we were kind of talking about off air, there's a tendency to over-intellectualize, and we do that a lot on Classic Movies, but I think that's great. I think it's good when you do something, if you do something like we did on Space Odyssey, which got super abstract and everything. But I think in True Grit in particular, it reminds me of like me being at my grandparents on a Sunday afternoon, and as soon as you switch it on, you're in a different world. You've got Glenn Campbell crooning away, and everything's wholesome, everything is in its right place, all the values make sense and are simple. And it's like putting on a nice warm pair of slippers, and the contrast with like the contrast when you do a bit of research on this, and when you look things up related to the movie, like because of the way we do it now, I do that on like a big computer, like you've got these other tabs open, and you're kind of conscious of all these other things going on at the same time. And it's kind of weird because you keep going back. I was keep going back to the True Grit sort of tab, and I was immediately getting de-stressed. I felt like that I was immediately in like a different place. So it's nice to have something which is just wholesome for the sake of being wholesome. You know what I mean?
Yeah, it definitely is. You know, I didn't really grow up with this version, so the first one I saw was the 2010 version, which our stream is going to be about the 1969 one primarily, but we will reference the other one because they are very similar movies. You know, John Wayne was not really somebody who I grew up with. I'm born in the 90s, so it's before my time, but when I started to get into some of his movies, it did kind of feel like you're going back to like a simpler time when things made a lot more sense. So I've always liked John Wayne for that reason. My dad would talk about him a bunch, but you know, I was already well into my teenage years or even 20s when I started to get into some of John Wayne's movies. So I don't know if it has the same nostalgia factor for me, but I definitely see what you mean, that it is something which, you know, you are able to kind of shut off the misery of the modern world when you turn on something with John Wayne. So I definitely know what you mean with that.
When you like get a look at John Wayne as well, there's different stages to John Wayne's career. I think there's probably three or four. So you've got John Wayne in Stagecoach. You've got the earlier stuff, which is obviously him as a sprightly young fella. And then I think into the 50s, you've got like John Wayne, Man Who Shot Liberty Valance, The Searchers. You've got John Wayne kind of at his peak as like the male leading. But then I think he was just such a presence that he kind of carried on that. And he, then when you get into the late 60s and the, even the 70s, John Wayne became the sort of he became fat and grizzly, but he was still carrying the film itself. And one of the weird things that I think this is something we could touch on a bit later is that I looked up that when John Wayne was in True Grit, he was actually he's actually like 16 years younger than what Donald Trump is now. And everybody thinks of him as being this really old man, but he was actually only 1 year older than Tom Cruise was in the last Mission Impossible movie. And when you have a look at the difference, like what, and somebody posted like Tony Soprano in The Sopranos, where I think he was like 36 when he started doing it, and he's sitting there like, and he's just like a middle-aged man, and then talking to the shrink. And people age differently, like in the old days.
I mean, I got into some of that with the Indiana Jones video, which I did a couple months ago about, we seem to be in this weird stasis in the culture today. Not that we need to get bogged down in this, that nothing ever changes. So it's the same celebrities that we had 20, 30 years ago. All these actors have been acting longer than I've even been born. Whereas, someone like John Wayne, he actually was somebody who aged gracefully. And, while he's playing the role of the old man, I actually feel that he doesn't feel as outdated in this as someone like Harrison Ford playing Indy in 2023. It does, because John Wayne is in this movie, he's supposed to be the old man. He's aging gracefully, so he's not the cowboy that he was in his prime. But he still has it. But he's kind of like actually has worked in that aspect. He's worked in that. Yeah, he's an older guy now, and that the character of Rooster Cockburn in this version of the film definitely reflects that. Whereas you see with the stuff today, it's like they can't move on from their glory days 20, 30 years ago. So while John Wayne is an older guy in this film, he doesn't feel outdated. Whereas for all that stuff today feels totally outdated.
Yeah, because he's just owned it. He, like, him being old is part of the part, him being old and fat is actually central to the whole plot. Because he is like this, and he's kind of full of regret. I mean, people are asking about the Coen Brothers one. Yeah, I think we're going to touch on that one later, and we're both pretty positive about that as well, to be honest. And in that one, he seems to be even more full of regret. But I mean, I suppose like we've already been going on for a bit, and I haven't even mentioned even touched on the plot, because that's a kind of standard format of classic movies. Is normally we get the plot out the way first. And for what it's worth, I mean, it's not exactly like a complicated story. You've got a young woman called Matty. Is it Matty Ross?
Matty Ross.
And her father's been shot down by the coward Cheney, and she's going into town and to take care of his business. I mean, I want to touch on that a little bit as well. But and then she wants to have him hanged, and they've got a hanging judge in town, which I always thought was funny as well. Like, as soon as you go to the town, there's like three men just being hanged, and the idea of living in a town where you've got a hanging judge, which it just sounds great to me.
And also consider how big this town probably is. What's the population? 2,000, 3,000.
Yeah, it's not much more than a village, and they've got like three men, giving their last words, and it's done in such a way that they're kind of prattling on about how they're innocent. There's worse than me out there, and then it's one of the halfway through saying something, and they just drop the trap door anyway, and snap their necks. And she's giving this like kind of, she goes to see the local marshal or something, and he's like, Who are the three like meanest people in the territory that I can send to hunt down the murdering coward Cheney? And he gives her like three options, and they're both better than Rooster Cogburn. But Rooster Cogburn's he's the worst. He's like the baddest. He doesn't even bring anybody in alive.
I like that in that scene. He says, well, this guy's the best tracker. Rooster Cockburn is the meanest, but I'd say the best is probably this guy here. But then she's like, tell me about this Rooster Cockburn.
Yeah, so then there's a bit of a weird thing that happens. We should probably come back to it, but she's kind of obsessed with penny pinching and haggling and threatening everybody with a lawyer. And I thought that was an interesting aspect of the movie. But it's too late for the sort of the deep stuff. But the Rooster Cogburn himself is on trial. Would you call that a trial?
Well, he's not on trial. He's a witness in a trial.
Yeah. And they're asking him. So he's just come back. We were introduced to him and he's unloading prisoners for these, like a cage full of scumbags that he's brought in from the wilderness. And he's like kicking him in the backside. Is he sending him into the jail and stuff like that? And he's sitting in the courtroom and they're asking him about, like, why did you kill like every male member of a family, more or less? And there's all these great lines that he comes out with to defend himself. And his story, if you listen carefully as well, his story just doesn't make any sense. Like he was much more aggressive, and he's coming across, he's trying to put it across as if it was just self-defense. And one of them came at him. He claims that he came at him with an axe. He was like an axe murderer or something, but it turns out he was just chopping wood with a hatchet next to the fire, and he shot him. And his story is like, yeah, so he came at me with the axe, and I shot him, and then his brother pulled his gun, so I shot him as well. And then his dad stood up from behind the fire, and he came towards me, so I shot him again. I shot him twice, actually. And then it's like you get this kind of thing where it's like, so if he ran after you, how was the father like face down in the fire? And he works all out, and it's clearly nonsensical. And there's a great line where he says, like John Wayne says, I was backing away, and you know, I was trying to get out of the situation. I was backing up. And then the lawyer says, like, which direction were you moving in? And he's saying, I was going backwards. I always go backwards when I back up. And the whole court's laughing. And I thought, it's class. It's class, this film, like, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. It's a good scene.
And then, you know, there's a bit more flannel goes on. It turns out that he lives with this Chinaman, as he calls him, in the back of a Chinese restaurant on this rock, like, wrecked cot with a cat called General Lee. And he basically just, like, slouches around like a slob in this cot, drinking, what does he call it? It's some kind of horrible kind of moonshine that he drinks, some kind of disgusting whiskey concoction that sends him into a stupor. So Matty comes around. And she's like, well, I want you to go after Cheney, the murdering coward, and I'll give you. And there's more haggling. Is he yet more haggling over money and about laws and contracts and things like that? And then they head off. And then there's a third character as well, who's a Texan, which is, he's kind of like the butt of the jokes. And he's a bit of a dandy. And he's always going on about how tough and how rugged they are in Texas, but he's kind of, yeah, he's not really that. And Rooster's not really buying his flannel at all. So basically the three of them go off, and there's a scene where they try to get one over on Matty because they don't really want her to go there. And she kind of comes across the river on the horse. And that impresses Rooster. That's the first sign of, like, somebody displaying true grit in the movie. So he kind of becomes more sympathetic to her. And that's kind of like how the movie kicks off onto the main adventure. You got nothing to add to that? Right, so carry on.
Sorry, I didn't know if you wanted me to step in. No, I think we can get the plot out of the way, then we can get in.
Yeah, and so then what happens is they go on the merry way, and there's lots of funny jokes between Rooster and the Texan, usually at the Texan's expense. I mean, my favorite one, I've got some of the lines saved here, some of the best lines. And there's one where he's talking about this is a good some of this, because what we used to call the patter in the movies just great, and this is like an exchange where Matty Ross says that tastes like iron, and le beef, oh, it's in French. I think that's on purpose as well to make it kind of effeminate. I don't know how you'd say that, but he says you're lucky to be. Obviously, I can't do the Western accents, but you're lucky to be where water's so handy. I've seen the time I've drank out of a filthy hoof print and was glad to get it. And Rooster Cogburn says, if I ever meet one of you Texas waddies who ain't drunk water from a hoof print, I think I'll shake their hand or buy them a Daniel Webster cigar. And LeBouf points to LeBouf's shaggy horse. And then Cogburn says, how long you boys been riding sheep down there? Because he's got, and it's there's all this kind of banter like that, which is there with all of this kind of banter is there. It doesn't push the plot along or anything, you know. It's not really a streamlined story. The whole kind of vibe, the whole thing of it, is to just enjoy the ride, like literally enjoy the ride, enjoy the characters, and it's taking its time, and I find it's so nice. Where I've seen it so many times, you know me where it's all gonna go, but it's so nice when you can just sit back and think, yeah, I don't really want to get to the end of the film. I just want to watch that. I just want to like look at the beautiful cinematography and the vistas and this spectacular scenery that we're in, and listen to them banter and kind of playfully take the piss out of each other like this. It's just great. So eventually they track down, it's a young Robert Duvall pops up and Dennis Hopper in the bad guys, and they smoke them out. There's a shootout, and then they track them down, and we'll come to sort of the end of the movie in a bit there, if you've got anything to add.
I think we can get the plot out of the way, then we can get...
So basically, they hunt them down. She shoots Chaney. Then she herself falls into a snake pit. She's bitten. Just before that happens, earlier in the story, Rooster is kind of recounting, as he does all the way through. He's telling stories of his life and his kind of wacky adventures and what he's been up to. And he tells a tale where, because he was, we'll get into this later, but he was actually a bit of a bandit and a bit of an outlaw himself, and he was being chased by Mexicans, and he turned around and he put the reins of the horse in his teeth so he could use both his six shooters, and then he charged straight for the Mexicans chasing him down, and they all scattered. So he pulls that move again, but again, like as an older, one-eyed fat man, where you get that great line where, what's the line when he says that's big talk for a one-eyed fat man? He's, I'm going to take you in. I'm going to take you in, Ned Pepper. I'm going to shoot you within 2 minutes, or I'm going to take you to the hanging church. And he says that's big talk from a one-eyed fat man. And then he puts the reins between his teeth and charges towards him. So he's like the little point that's being made is that, yeah, he's old and he's a little bit past it, but he's still got that true grit. He's still got that spirit within him, you know, never to give up and to keep on going, which is great. It's a great positive message. So then he has to get Maddie back to civilization to get the snake out, to get the snake poison out, which means that he really pulls all the stops out. He rides the horse into the ground and all of this kind of thing. And that's kind of where that the John Wayne one leaves off.
Yeah. So in terms of the character of Rooster Cogburn, I mean, like the title of the movie True Grit is a reference to his kind. It's a reference to the character. It's a reference to him, and you know, he is the one-eyed old fat guy who lives in the back of a shack owned by some Chinese guy, and gets drunk and is totally drunk all the time. But he's really good at one thing, and he's really good at catching bad guys. It's also interesting some of the backstory that they give for Rooster. So. During the Civil War, he had fought in a guerrilla unit that was run by, his name was, I have it here, William, hold on a second.
Quantrill.
Quantrill. William Quantrill. So basically this guy was a guerrilla leader during a Confederate guerrilla leader during the Civil War. And he was known for basically being this outlaw and this butcher who, we'll get onto that a bit later, but who even had killed civilians. So basically, Rooster was, during the war, he was probably a really mean SOB there as well, and probably had done some pretty awful things during that time. They also say that he had committed robbery before becoming a U.S. Marshal. In the 69 version, they say that he robbed a federal paymaster, whereas in the 2010 version, they say he robbed a bank. So he also has like a criminal background as well. So he isn't exactly an idealist. In fact, pretty much anything, he's the complete opposite of it. He really is kind of just this brash and rough drunk who's just good at catching bad guys. And he becomes a U.S. Marshal because it pays money and he's good at it. They say that he's known as not necessarily the best marshal in this county in Arkansas, but he is the meanest, as in like he might not be the best, the one who's most likely to bring the bad guy in to face justice, but he's probably the most likely to make the bad guy suffer. So he goes through most of the movie kind of being this gun for hire who's obviously very cynical, doesn't really have a very good life, but then he really kind of develops into this father figure for Maddie, which we can get into a bit later as well. And toward the end of the movie, he desperately tries and succeeds to save her life. So he really kind of develops an appreciation for her, and he eventually begins to value something else in life, because otherwise, his life is kind of like a wreck other than that, but he actually gains something good out of it.
There's a thing that I picked up on when I watched it, when it's especially the front part of the movie with Matty, it really jumps out at you now after watching, you watch other Westerns and you go about watching something like this. And I wanted to say something about the way, like, she's, we'll get on to like the possible feminist thing. I don't really buy that. I think I think there would have been these kind of puritanical women out on these kind of Protestant types out on the plains in the American West. And if you notice, she's obsessive about counting pennies and haggling and this very kind
and
of
the law American, as well.
And the law, this very, very kind of mercantile mindset. Now, I was reading a book. I thought I would just slip this in here because I've been reading a book called The Coming Caesars, which is kind of, it's kind of a Spenglerian take on America specifically. I may have much more to say on this book in the future. But just for now, I thought I would pick up on it because one of the things that is pointed out by this writer, who this is written from 1952, and he's kind of pointing out the similarities between America and Rome. And there's a part here that I thought I would read out, which kind of relates to what we're talking about, because he says that he compares specifically the Anglo-American world to Rome, and then the European continent itself to Hellenistic Greece in terms, the Spengler stuff. But and in the sort of Anglo-American world, it's very much based on mercantilism and laws. America is a land of laws. Now, that seems weird because you think, well, all lands are lands of laws. And I'll just read what he says on this, which is related to this. It says, this growing ascendancy, unknown on the European continent, was due to the influence of English legalistic thinking. Anglo-Saxon law is a law of precedence, entailing a pragmatic concern for time and tradition, for organic growth rather than timeless logic. A law of precedence is utterly opposed to a law of reasons and fosters an immense conservatism. This has been reflected time and again in American history. The result is that whereas any layman can understand a European code if he cares to read the logical and permanent fixed document, Nothing is more obscure than British and American legislation and its illogical accumulation of precedents, tradition-bound, tied to concrete and particular cases and not abstract generalities, and always in a state of change. Tocqueville expressed it this way: the French lawyer is simply a man extensively acquainted with the statutes of his country, but the Englishman or American lawyer resembles the hierophants of Egypt. For them, he is the sole interpreter of an occult science. And it's why you can see things which seem just completely baffling. The amount of obsession with the laws and what little loopholes and what little wriggle room you can get around. And it's as almost as if, like, it's kind of weird because it's like morality's got nothing to do with it. But I think it when you then get back to the basics, I mean, notice the way that they want to bring in, like he says to Matty that he'll bring in Cheney and Lucky Ned Pepper, and she's free to torture Cheney all she wants, and he'll help her do it. He'll burn the soles of his feet. She can feed him sand, but he will have to face the judge. He will have to face justice. In other words, like, yeah, you can torture him and do what you want, but there's the law. It's kind of weird. And just another passage here, he says, the result has been to transform American lawyers into a class endowed with immense influence. I mean, we see this today. America today is just obsessive with these weird... Just look at what's happening with Donald Trump. An influence that increased steadily as democracy gained the upper hand and destroyed the privileges of the gentry. In time, the lawyers came to substitute for the departed gentry, and their influence on American politics can never be overestimated. The absence of marked disorders and upheaval in America's growing democracy is wholly due to this prestige and power of the lawyer class. The historical result is today clear. 24 out of 32 presidents, when he made this, wrote this book, have been either lawyers or connected with the legal profession. Between half and two-thirds of the seats in Congress have usually been filled by lawyers. Whereas Britain's ruling aristocracy has always been able to absorb and control British lawyers, their American counterparts have remained unchallenged in a country where democratic equality had made them indispensable. They alone lived in time and shared an organic outlook in a country that was living almost exclusively in geographical space with a mechanical outlook on things. They became the trustees of America's historic destiny. And I thought that was a very interesting to think about, because they literally say, in regards to the movie, that because Matty keeps going on about Lawyer Daggett, and whatever happens... Yes. Whatever happens, if somebody's going to rip her off, or if John Wayne doesn't get the job done, or whatever, it's and she pulls out like Lawyer Daggett will be in touch, and everybody's terrified. And I think it's the LaBeouf even says she pulls Lawyer Daggett like a pistol. So it's strange, because you see this kind of emergence of this legalistic lawyer obsessed Americanism in this through this kind of Protestant puritanical Matty Ross figure.
Like there's that scene where she goes to the guy who owns the horses stable, and then she says, well, you owe me a horse and you owe me $300 or something like that, and then, well, my father purchased these ponies, but then the sale must be null and void, and since my father's horse was stolen while it was in your care, then I don't know how this actually works. I think I kind of lost the script on this one, but apparently he ends up giving her $300 and a horse or something like that. And basically, like, these kind of legalese, like the phrase that exists, legalese, to describe something that only a lawyer really even understands. She's able to get $300 out of him and the horse, and then to retain her father's saddle as well, which she then uses to pay Rooster Cockburn for to go off and hunt down Tom Cheney. She offers him $50 for when he leaves, and then $50 for when they come back with him. And then there's even the scene where she then. Once he's going off, once he's trying to, like, ditch her and go off without her, she says that, well, I'm going to then report that my money was stolen because you going off with without me is not part of the deal. And there's another dynamic here that LaBeef is also after Tom Chaney because in Texas, Tom Chaney, who was under another name at the time, had murdered a Texas senator. And LaBeef is trying to bring Chaney back to is trying to bring Chaney back to Texas in order to have him hanged for this murder and to collect the big reward money that he has waiting for him. And Maddie is absolutely outraged at this idea. She's saying, no, he must be hanged in Arkansas County, wherever it is, for the murder of my father, not hanged in Texas. And then I think both LaBeef and Cockburn both say to him, like, does it really matter where he's hanged? As long as he is hanged, does it matter? And she says, well, no, he must be hanged for the murder of my father. And then they say, well, he'll be hanged for the murder of the senator and for the murder of your father. But that's, she's having none of that. It's really interesting because it's a revenge story. Like a big theme in True Grit is the theme of revenge. But her kind of way of revenge is not necessarily to use like physical violence against him, but to use the law kind of to enact her own vengeance, if you know what I mean. Because you mentioned that there's a part where Cockburn says to her that, well, I'll allow you to torture him, shove sand in his mouth, put a bunch of cuts in him before we bring him in and hang him. And she says, no, I have no desire to do this. I have no desire to do that. And she even says, well, I hope that he hasn't, because basically Chaney and the gang that he joined ran off into Indian territory. And I think at some time she even says, I hope he has not already died, because it's not enough for him to just simply die and even like suffer a painful death. She wants it to be in this state, in this county in Arkansas, being hanged precisely for the murder of her father. And that's like extremely important to her. So you really see that, like, you know, she is this, she does have this, like, she is on kind of a path of vengeance, but then her way of enacting that is like by enforcing the law to a T.
And you see as well, because of course the whole issue with Rooster Cogburn, and it's funny because people would compare Clint Eastwood and John Wayne a lot. And one of the things they've got in common is this thing where they want to do what's right. At the end of the day, regardless of the law, you have to actually kill the bad guys. You do have to have, otherwise they're going to run riot. And regardless of the law, that's something that has to happen. And a frequent theme we covered it in the Dirty Harry review as well, the Dirty Harry classic movies, is again, you get this time there's a much more overt liberal kind of flavor to the law, to lawyers and the bureaucratic machine. And in this one, because you're in the Wild West, it's obviously a lot more primitive, but it's still there as a kind of seed, as a sort of in embryonic form. And the problem, the thing with Rooster is that it's almost as if he's from this older world where it at the end of the day, like, if you've got somebody who's committed murder, you're going to have to go out, you're going to have to bring them to jail, you're going to have to kill them. You're going to have to put these people down like dogs. Otherwise, civilization can't flourish. And the question then becomes, what happens, which we've got in the real world today, to be honest, when the law actively hinders that that happening? And so it's interesting that Rooster's in the court, like being harangued by lawyers right at the first time we kind of were introduced to the character. Because you can see that he's walking a very fine line between upholding civilization and upholding the law. And it's the same tension as what you'll find in something like Dirty Harry. Now, in the actual Clint Eastwood westerns, it's a lot more, the law's a lot more distant. He kind of just does whatever he wants. But in John Wayne and in other John Wayne movies, I think this pops up quite a bit. And it's this idea where, regardless of these effeminate lawyers, somebody out there has to be like defending civilization, defending the sheep against the wolves, if you like. And that's kind of John Wayne's role. I think that's John Wayne's role in movies and even in American history in a way.
Yeah. So the scene with the trial, I think that's the first time we see Cockburn in the movie is when he's unloading those criminals into the jailhouse. And then the next, Maddie tries to talk to him, but then she doesn't get a chance to. Then the next scene with him is when he's in the courtroom testifying. So to clarify, what's going on in this scene is that some of the guys who he has arrested are on trial. So some of the criminals that he has brought in are on trial for whatever crimes that they were accused of. And Rooster Cogburn has been called as a witness. And it's the defense that the defense lawyers are haranguing him over. As they put it, they even say to him, well, how many men have you shot in your time as marshal? And then he says, shot. Here's another great line from this scene. He says, shot or killed. And then the defense lawyer says, well, let's limit it to killed, because we want to actually have a manageable amount or something like that. And then he even misremembers the actual number. He had killed even more than he had given the answer to. It's interesting that we can contrast this scene where he's in the courtroom answering for, every painstakingly answering for each detail of the crime. Well, at this time he picked up the hatchet and then he moved over here. And then I shot him when this happened. And then then I shot him here. And it's like kind of going over this exchange, which was probably quite brutal in reality, in this like really like painstaking detail. And he even says that, how did the father get into the fire? Then a boar might have pushed him in there. It's really, obviously his story really was obviously not true. It's clear that he basically gunned these guys down because he thought they were scumbags and that they just needed to be taken out. He also gets quite annoyed with all of the legalese from Maddie. So when she's saying, well, as your employer, I mean, imagine being a middle-aged guy in your 50s with an eye patch who had fought in the Civil War, and to have a 14-year-old girl say to you, as your employer, just imagine that. But
yeah, it's the legalese again.
Yeah. So then he goes off and for the bulk of the movie, for the rest of it, that entire like legalism doesn't exist, because they're way off in Indian territory, where the movie even says that Arkansas has no jurisdiction in Indian territory. So that's something that only federal agents can go out there, because the local law enforcement have no jurisdiction there. So their laws do not apply in this Indian territory. So he goes off and then we have once they go off into the wilderness to chase Cheney, all of this legalism just goes out the window, because you're in this very sparsely populated area where, these gangs, these criminals like Cheney and Ned's gang, they just run rampant, and all of that legalism just doesn't exist. And they even like bring this back at the end. So, you mentioned, Lawyer Daggett, how Maddie constantly is bringing up Lawyer Daggett throughout the movie. And then at the end, John Wayne is expecting Lawyer Daggett to be this like imposing guy and this like really intimidating person. And they even have it a bit different in the 2010 version. I don't think you actually see him in that version. You just hear his voice through a note that he wrote to Maddie, where he's saying, well, I really think you should leave these matters to me. And the voice is like really deep. And, he sounds like probably a pretty imposing guy. But in the 1969 version, when you see him at the end, if you want to know which actor it is, if you've seen 12 Angry Men, the actor that played like the really like submissive, shy, small, balding guy in 12 Angry Men, that's the guy they have play Lawyer Daggett at the end. And Cogburn is just shocked. He's like, this is Lawyer Daggett? This is the guy who I have been threatened with this entire time? The guy who I've been running scared of? Like, because it's a totally different world. In his world, someone like Lawyer Daggett would be, he wouldn't make it a day, because, he's not a physically tough guy. He's a guy that, his weapon is this legalese. Whereas in the world in the town, well, Lawyer Daggett is a big shot, because, he has this, extremely complex legal system backing him up. And it's not the physicality and the grit, to borrow the term of the film, that rules in the civilized world. It's this kind of it's this kind of legalism.
Yeah, it's like the lawyer longhouse. That's what they call it now, isn't it? The longhouse, where like a sort of passive, wimpish femininity rules over like the gruff masculine man outside, and it's this is what chaffs at John Wayne throughout the movie. I mean, this is a recurring theme on, we've done a lot of the westerns, and especially on one of the Once Upon a Time in the West, where you do see this kind of, it is this kind of, there's a sadness to it. This is much more emphasized in The Shootist, The Shootist is explicit about the changing of the times. True Grit, we're not quite there yet. True Grit, the lawyers are still these wimps, and they're kind of a pain in the arse. And it's, by the time you get to the Shootist or something in a slightly different way with Once Upon a Time in the West, it's like the bureaucracy is arriving in fully. But in True Grit, of course, he's just a little wimp who needs to be smacked around. But the writing is on the wall that you can see it, the way that even John Wayne has to abide by the sort of the longhouse of the lawyers, where all these bullshit little rules and bureaucratic regulations are going to slip you up, and it kind of castrates the patriarch himself. I think as well, it's kind of when I mean, if you just kind of step back a moment and you think of John Wayne as an American archetype of his age, and it was like this kind of patriotic roaming around on the land, you can see why there's this sort of libertarian thing infused in it, and what the kind of the tentacles of law kind of coming after you and kind of preventing you from living the life that you want to live and be how you want to be. Like, you can see why that tension exists, you know. You can see how that kind of comes around. And in the end, it didn't stop. It just became what today they call the cathedral or managerialism and all of these. There's just this endless kind of wall of bullshit which just saps the very life out. It's like ivy growing over a tree and eventually just can't see the tree anymore. But at least in True Grit, it's not as pessimistic. It's certainly not really a pessimistic movie. I'm a pessimistic kind of fella, so I tend to pick up on these kind of things. But really, I think it's a story of it's a girl like maturing and learning that, learning a thing, going on a journey about life, but then also sort of John Wayne returning to life in a way, and sort of returning to sort of actually being vindicated in his views. And he certainly doesn't change. And he's kind of got a youthful spring in his step. The final moment in True Grit 1969 is where he jumps over the fence. And it's all about this kind of growing old disgracefully, because you're well aware that he's overweight. He's only got one eye. He's got gray hair. He's not pretending to be young. He's not. It's not like Tom Cruise with like CGI makeup or all of this kind of thing now. It is like he's an old man and he's not pretending to be young, but he's still got some kick. He's like this old war horse that can still kick hard. And that's kind of a life affirming message. Which, you know, when you get to my age, you can kind of appreciate it.
Yeah, I don't know if you wanted to do the part where we talk about the endings of the two different versions yet. Maybe we can save that for a bit later. I mean, I did have a few things to say about the character of Maddie, because there is an argument like, you know, is this movie pushing feminism hard? I don't really get that. I don't really get the sense that it is, because I mean, you know, I do think that she is annoying in scenes. Like, I she is meant to be a brat, though. You know, it's not like it's not like she's now going to become the big bad bounty hunter who goes out into the Indian territories alone and brings back the bad guys. Like, that's clearly not going to happen. And they even like they keep her in the character that, you know, she is kind of this like dopey teenager, even though she, you know, has read a bit too much about law and has ingested a bit too much legalese out in the Indian territory. She is still kind of this clumsy dope. Like, I really like this scene where So it's just as they're on the trail of the gang. And then I think that there's like some kind of dispute between Rooster and LaBeef. And Maddie goes down to the river to fetch some water with a bucket or something like that. And then just as she goes down to the water, none other than Tom Chaney himself is standing down in the water. And she just comes face to face with the guy that they're hunting. And she pulls out her father's pistol. And you can see that, like, if for anyone who knows guns, you know that she's not holding it correctly at all. You know, it's like this kind of like really weak, like the wrists are not straight. You know, the elbows are bent inwards. Like, you know, it's not at all how you're supposed to hold a gun. And she says to him, like, "I'm taking you in, Tom Chaney." And then he says, "Well, you might want to cock the revolver." And then she pulls it back and he's like, no, you gotta pull the hammer back all the way. And she's like, "I know how to do it." And it's a really good scene because, you know, that's probably how a 14-year-old girl would react in a situation like that. She is like way out of her depths. And she actually does shoot. She shoots him, but then I think it's kind of like grazes his rib or something. And then he takes her in and captures her and brings her into the gang. You know, I find like, yeah, especially at the beginning of the movie, she is kind of annoying. She really does seem like a brat. And like I said, like, I can imagine it'd probably be a bit frustrating having like some 14-year-old, if you're like a Civil War veteran, a bounty hunter, U.S. Marshal, who is, with only one eye, and, you know, having a 14-year-old say, like, as your employer, I can see how that wouldn't make you happy. But towards the end of the movie, I find you start to like Maddie a lot more. So in the last scenes when she has been captured by the gang, you're really hoping for her to pull through because, you know, she kind of becomes that lovable daughter figure to Rooster Cogburn's father figure. So, you know, she's a bit irritating at scenes in the movie, but that is intentional because that's kind of how this character would be. I don't think it's irritating because they're pushing feminism. I think it's that she's kind of annoying in scenes because that's what the character is meant to be. But toward the end of the movie, you really do get to like her, and you are really hoping for her to pull through.
And the difference is, beside the fact that she's got Lawyer Daggett and a little bit of money, if you wanted to like go full in on sort of the power dynamic thing, all she's got is a big mouth to begin with, which she kind of loses across the movie. And again, I can well imagine a lot of the women in the Old West actually being like that, regardless of modern feminism. Now, of course, you would get some people who would say that some of the problems that we face today are rooted in that kind of puritanism of the American Old West, which is I know you don't agree with it at all, but it is a take. It's out there. But it's interesting as well. Like, don't forget that LaBeouf actually puts her over his knee and smacks her like a child, like spanks her like a little child. And he Rooster Cogburn just sits back and watches him do it. He's even kind of chuckling and like drinking his whiskey. But then he picks up a branch of a tree and she's saying, "Are you going to let him keep doing this?" And then he says, "No, I don't think I will." And he pulls out his gun. And it's kind of like, yeah, she's a pain. Yet she's like, she's got a big mouth and she's really irritating. But there's limits. I'm not going to sit by. And he says, "You're enjoying it too much." So it's one thing to chastise the girl. It's one thing, especially because, like, what is she, like 16? Like, putting a 16-year-old girl over your knee and like spanking her, like, yeah, that's and then, of course, when it's becoming a little bit too gratuitous, bullying in a way, then it's like, okay, that's enough. This isn't going any further. We're not doing this.
Yeah, that's a good scene. Then there's the character of LaBeef is also one that's pretty interesting, especially the contrast between him and Cogburn. So with LaBeouf, he's a Texas Ranger, and he's somebody who holds some higher ideals. I mentioned earlier that with Rooster Cogburn, he's basically this he's basically a gun for hire. He's more or less a bounty hunter. He's a U.S. Marshal because he's good at going off and killing bad guys and bringing them to justice, not because he believes in some kind of higher form of justice. LaBeouf, he holds some higher ideals. So he's extremely proud of being a part of the Texas Rangers. He talks about it a lot through the film. He says, "Oh, I'm a Texas Ranger." And then that's in contrast to Rooster's cynicism. Like you mentioned the scene where he says like, "Oh, well, I had to drink out of a horse's hoof print." And then Rooster saying, "Oh yeah, I've heard that story a million times." But also like LaBeouf, he doesn't entirely live up to his ideals. So at the beginning, it is clear that he isn't really going after Chaney. He might believe in the law, certainly a lot more than Rooster does, but he does have like some monetary interests in mind. So he is going to take him back to Texas so he can get the reward. And he also expects that he'll be able to win a certain woman's hand in marriage if he brings back Chaney alive to face punishment in Texas. So it's not like he's like a total idealist. He is motivated by his own self-interest as well. But in contrast to Rooster, he is definitely one who holds a lot more ideals than simply just like find bad guy and get paid for it. There's a great scene where him and Rooster argue over their service during the Civil War. So as I mentioned, during the American Civil War, it tells us that Rooster fought for William Quantrill. So he was a guerrilla leader who in the actual history had carried out this horrible massacre. It was called the Lawrence Massacre, in which this unit of guerrilla fighters had killed a couple hundred civilians in Missouri during the war. And for anyone who doesn't know, Missouri was a border state during the war. So Missouri never actually joined the Confederacy, but it came very close at times. And the state of Missouri itself was divided between North and South because many people in the state of Missouri was a slave state. Many people in Missouri sympathized with the Confederacy, even though the state never actually ended up joining. In contrast, LaBeouf served in the Army of Northern Virginia. So he served under the command of General Lee. And he views his own service as something which is honorable because he joined the regular army. He fought under an honorable man like General Lee. He fought the men that he fought and killed were combatants. They were soldiers in another standing army. And he did what he did because he thought that's what was right. Whereas he views Rooster's service as being views him as being this barbarian who killed civilians, including women and children. Interesting historical note is that Rooster Cockburn was a fictional character, but the unit that the movie said that he served in, Jesse James actually served in this unit. And there have been people who speculated that Jesse James's criminality later in his his life as an outlaw was largely influenced by his time in this guerrilla fighting unit. So there is this contrast between the two. LaBeouf basically sees Rooster as being this savage and this brute barbarian who's really not much better than the criminals that he brings in. He just brings them in for money. Whereas I think that Rooster kind of sees LaBeouf as this self-righteous bureaucratic and kind of naive idealist who really doesn't have the place out in the old West that Rooster does. You know, Rooster's the man who has the grit to survive out there. Whereas LaBeouf is someone who talks a big gang, who talks a big game, but he talks the talk, but he really doesn't walk the walk.
But what I think strange, because you had to correct me on this, because I thought John Wayne was fighting for the North. And that's why he got little one-liners in, little jabs in at LaBeouf. But so it turns out he was actually with Quantrell's Raiders. And what I think's odd about this is that if you go on the Wikipedia page for Bill Cantrell, and I realize you're going to, the victors write the history, but he is depicted as a butcher. And I just think it's a strange choice to have John Wayne in that role. Like, I can understand if they were to put John Wayne in the role. I mean, yeah, it is based on a book as well. So it does give it, you can, I think, I haven't read the book, but I think this is a bit of a narrative problem for them, for a John Wayne movie, which wouldn't be so sort of, which wouldn't be so much of a thing with the book, because in the book, what it would do would add a kind of darker history to Rooster's character. But the problem when you do then transfer that all over into a John Wayne movie is that all of a sudden you've got John Wayne as Rooster, who's this like lovable, likable, rough character. But then he's all of a sudden got this, he's got this sort of association with these people who are seen as butchers. Do you know what I mean? And then he turns around and he says that all of the rumors are just lies. Like, they weren't like that at all.
He basically, he owns being part of them. So I can't remember exactly. Does he deny that they engaged in the things that...
LaBeouf puts it to him that they murdered women and children, and he turns around and he says, that's a damn lie. I've heard that rumor as well, and that's a damn lie. And yet, since then, it seems like, well, I don't know about this stuff. I did actually try to get an American on for the stream for this, but we didn't manage it. But so what I think's interesting is that basically this would put sort of John Wayne on the side of the bad guys, you know, or like in like the modern mythology of America and the West. Whereas if LaBeouf was if John Wayne was then just fighting along with General Lee, and it was LaBeouf who was in Quantrell's radars, then that would have more. I could kind of understand that more. Do you see what I mean?
Well, I don't think it would fit with the character, though, because, you know, I think LaBeouf is some guy who, like I mentioned, you know, maybe he's a bit self-righteous, but he does seem to believe in certain ideals, whereas Rooster seems to be a lot more cynical. Now, I know he turns out to be a nice guy, but I don't feel like it would fit really as well. I mean, there it's possible what they could have done was they could have had one of them fight for the North. So would you say that it makes John Wayne a criminal in the American mythos in terms of like the fact that he fought for the South at all, or the fact that he, I mean, I know it's the character, not John Wayne himself, but would it be that he's a criminal because he fought for the South at all, or because he particularly was involved in this guerrilla unit?
Well, it's a strange thing, because I think in America they passed through certain stages, which is where I thought they were going to go for. Where, so in 1969, they seem to have put this stuff largely to bed, where you can have the leading man, you can have John Wayne fighting for the South, and that would be, in a way, kind of putting the old wounds of the Civil War to bed. But one of the outliers to the South would be that they had these kind of guerrillas who murdered women and children, according to the narrative of the movie. And that's something quite different, because then you're putting him kind of not just in an opposing army, but as being something much more sinister. But that's if it's in the book, they've just gone along with it. And they went along with it in the 2010 one as well. So it's kind of strange. It's that they would, I mean, it's I guess, It's true to the book, but it's if you look at then John Wayne as the all-American kind of patriarch, it just puts him in a strange place.
But wouldn't you say, like, in the context of this movie, though, he kind of was a bastard, though, before the final act, like, you know, yeah. I mean, he is known as being the meanest marshal in this.
That's where you come to it. So when you get to the archetype of John Wayne, he is, I wouldn't say that he's rough. He's rough around the edges, certainly. And he, you know, he drinks a lot. But if you look at the case where LaBeouf is spanking Maddie, and then he's going to pick up that tree branch, then he steps in and he says no. Now, this is the John Wayne we recognize. It's like, yes, the girl's got a big mouth. She needs to be chastised. She needs to be put in her place. But we're not going to descend into this kind of sadism. Whereas if then you are like, if he was with Quantrell's Raiders and he was this gorilla alleged where they killed women and children, then he probably wouldn't do that. Do you see? Then it steps outside. There's a kind of limit to how far you can go with that while retaining the John Wayne mythos. So you can say, yeah, the girl needs to be given a smack and chastised because she's too mouthy, but you're not going to be able to kind of do it's not going to descend into sadism. There's going to have to be a line, a civilization line drawn here. But that then, if he is being involved with these people who murdered women and children, which he denies, to be fair, then it kind of brings that into question, you know?
But I mean, it also they also do say that he had committed robbery. Now, it's obviously not as damning as murdering women and children, but I do think that, I mean, the character is meant to kind of be like this. He's basically not meant to be a saint. He's meant to be kind of this, you know, vicious bastard who eventually, who you know, is just good at catching bad guys. So, I mean, I see what you mean. I see that, like, you know, if you were putting John Wayne in that kind of role, it does kind of like, it does kind of undermine his image as kind of the all-American hero, at least the all-American hero on the screen. But yeah, I mean, I don't really know how to answer that. I do find that it's a fascinating dynamic in the movie between Labeef's service versus Rooster's service. But how that ties in with John Wayne, I don't know how to answer that really.
There's another just on the subject of deep lore. If you remember in Clint Eastwood's Outlaw Josie Wales, at the start he gets his family wiped out, but by the North, by the Redlegs. And then there's somebody comes along, and it's great. And I think it's Vernon something or other, the actor. He's a great actor. And he finds Wales sort of all scarred, and his house is burned down. His wife, I mean, Clint Eastwood's movies are a lot more brutal than John Wayne's. And he kind of picks him up, and he sorts him out, and he says, my name's Bill Anderson, Bloody Bill, I think it is. And so Clint Eastwood went riding with them again. That's who's Outlaw Josie Wales is with as well. So there's kind of a crossover, and that's what they call Bloody Bill Anderson. And then eventually he gets shot as well. So it's interesting, isn't it, how you get all this crossover in the lore.
Unfortunately, I haven't seen that movie, so I can't say.
Well, I would say that's very strong on the movies we'll cover. But this is one of the problems that, I'm just a bloke from Northern England. There's limits when you get into the lore of the Deep South and all of this. Maybe we can get an American on for that one. But it's funny. It's especially because he just denied it. Because then you think, John Wayne here, because then in the wider American narrative, you would think that they would have the Southern guerrillas as being something almost akin to the Gestapo. I mean, as with in new, like, woke America, they're pulling all of the statues down. They want rid of the Confederate flag and all of that. So it's become – So then you've got John Wayne, in the movie as the American icon, like, so yeah, I was with that. I was with the
gorillas. Oh, they don't need to use a movie. They have enough on John Wayne to cancel him these days. More than enough. If you've seen some of the things that he said when he was alive, you know what I'm referring to.
Yeah, yeah, it's
okay. Yeah,
there's all kinds of interviews he did with John Wayne. He's based, and well, there's a super chat somebody on the coffee pot, which I'll come to a bit later, which we're going to touch on something.
Like what that. I'd like to add is that, like, it's also important to remember the different interpretations of the American Civil War throughout American history. So, for the longest time, like, very little of it had to do with race or with slavery or with the blacks and things like that. For the longest time, it was seen as this, like, great tragedy of America, that, you know, it was this Well, it was brothers fighting brothers. It was like guys who should have been should have been countrymen killing each other, neighbor versus neighbor. A few years ago, I watched this pretty interesting lecture series by Columbia University on the different interpretations of the American Civil War. And they, like, for example, the way that first World War One and then World War Two later shaped the interpretation. So after World War One, which was seen as this huge slaughter, a waste of an entire generation, all these lives of young men just thrown away for nothing. The American Civil War kind of became viewed in a very similar way. Whereas like it was seen as like this, you know, this war that never should have happened, a bunch of lives thrown away. The mindset of the day was that, you know, war was really just a waste of life following the Great War. But prior to that, maybe they had been even a bit more revered. I remember I did a video a couple years ago on William James and like a speech that he gave. And he talks about the memory of the American Civil War, and he talks about how valuable that was to America. Now, he gave that speech before World War One, so I think in very early 20th century. In this lecture series I watched, they talked about how following World War II, the post-war narrative that we got was kind of superimposed onto the American Civil War. I think that's kind of like that the dial on that has been turned up, as has happened with the World War II narrative. The idea that like the South was like was horrible and irredeemable in every conceivable way, I don't think that was really part of the narrative until very recently. So that's obviously what the establishment and the media, the universities, that's what they'll tell you about the American Civil War today. But that's a lot more of a recent interpretation. In the 1960s, now, of course, it was starting to change by then, but someone still could have fought for the South and still have been a good guy. Now, maybe they couldn't have engaged in this massacre, whether that happened or not. You know, I'm not gonna get into the history because I don't think I know enough about it. But someone still in American lore, in John Wayne's time, could have fought for the South and still been considered a good guy in America. That's obviously not the case today.
Yeah, I mean, so should we move on to the 2010 one then? Because obviously the story's pretty much identical. Even some of the lines are the same. But I do think it's a fine film. Let's be honest, we're always slagging off more recent movies from after 2000 or so. But the Coen Brothers one, and yes, we know, but it's genuinely a very enjoyable watch. But it's got darker tones than the John Wayne one, I think.
Well, yeah. So this one was the one that I actually saw first. So I saw the Coen Brothers version in theaters when I was 15. I didn't see the John Wayne version until about a year or two ago for the first time, and then I watched it again in anticipation for this stream. So for me, the story of True Grit, it brings up the memory of the 2010 film more than the 1969 one. I will say I like both of the movies. They're both really good, and I do feel that the 2010 one, it was a good remake because, you know, it's not one of these situations that we see today that they find something from 30 years ago and remake it because they just they have no ideas and they have nothing else to do. They're an extremely similar movie, but then the tone is very different. So I swear they even must have shot it on the same location because it feels like to me the landscapes that they're traveling over are identical. I don't know too much about the production of the 2010 movie, but it seems like to me that it was shot in the exact same place. And yeah, I know people in the chat will say the Coen brothers and we all know who they are, but you know, I didn't see anything too bad in this movie that too objectionable. I'd say that the difference between the two of them is that the first one, the 1969 one, is very optimistic, whereas the 2010 one is very pessimistic. The stories diverge in the last like 10 minutes of the movie. So, the John Wayne version ends with, like you mentioned earlier, He drops off Maddie at the farm, and he even says something like, you know, when you go on and have kids of your own or something like that, he's become her new father figure. And, he then rides off and jumps over the four post fence or whatever they call it. He does this huge jump on his horse, which he shouldn't be able to do at his age. And John Wayne, the symbol of American optimism in the post-war era, rides off into the distance. And, you know, you go home with that happy feeling. Whereas in the 2010 version, the last time that Maddie actually sees Rooster is as she's passing out, because she gets bitten by this rattlesnake, and he has to race to find a doctor because they're in the middle of Indian territory. There's obviously not one nearby. He has to race to find the doctor. He runs the horse into the ground. Another thing you notice, well, actually I should back up a bit. One thing that is worth noting is that in the John Wayne version, Maddie shoots Chaney and then falls into the rattlesnake pit, but then it doesn't actually mortally wound Chaney. So he gets back up, and then and it's actually Rooster who delivers the death blow. He's the one who fatally shoots Chaney. Whereas in the Coen Brothers version, Maddie is the one who actually delivers the shot that kills Chaney. And then this introduces another theme that she actually had killed someone now. And the last time she sees Rooster is when he leaves her with the doctor. She passes out, and then she doesn't hear from him for, I think they said 25 years. And 25 years, the film ends with her as a middle-aged woman. 25 years later, she had never married. She's missing an arm from the rattlesnake bite. That doesn't happen in the 69 version. In this one, they had to amputate her arm to save her. And she goes she hears that Rooster is performing at some traveling circus. And she finds that when she gets there, he died only 3 days earlier. And, he had been buried in a Confederate graveyard, and she then has him excavated and then buried in her family's lot. So, you know, it's a very like pessimistic ending, which you don't see in the original version. But I actually think it fits, because I don't want to get too much into politics of the present day, but when you consider the America of the past 13 years after this movie was released, and then the years that are to come, there is really isn't that much to be optimistic about. And I find that it's actually very fitting, because, you know, you in the John Wayne movie, you always feel like the good guys win, and then we can all go home happy. Whereas, you know, some guy living in 1969 probably felt that way about, and in 1969 America probably felt that way about his country. Whereas I don't think you can feel that way today. So I think it actually is quite fitting.
I mean, there's a lot. I think the 2010 one, it seems a lot more literary. So she's telling the story from her own perspective, which I think is the way the novel is written. You always get the best takes on my platforms. So I did a little bit of snooping around to see, you know, what takes people have on True Grit. And almost nobody has video essays out on the 1969 one, which we've just spent like 70 minutes talking about. But when it comes to this one, the Coen Brothers one, there's quite a few video essays out there, which is typical for their thing. You know, the YouTube video essayists really like the Coen Brothers. And so they do actually have some interesting things to say on this. The one that jumped out at me, there's a lot of crossover apparently with No Country for Old Men. And in No Country for Old Men, Tommy Lee Jones gives a monologue about his father. I think it's about his father dying or something. And he talks about walking towards a light. And in the opening shot to True Grit 2010 is like literally what he's describing. You see it. And it's Maddie's father dying. That's because he gets shot. He comes out of the door and you see him lying there, and it's in the dark, but you see the light of the, so there's a kind of layering there. There's a kind of symbolism going on. And then throughout the film, it's got all these references to mythology, which a lot of the Coen Brothers movies do. And one of the things that you'll see is that she says, when I walk through the shadow of the valley of death. Now, much later on in the movie, well, so when she shoots Chaney, she kills him, she falls into the pit, and then she's down on the, she gets bitten by the snake, of course, because she's sort of symbolically descended into hell, and she's staring up from the bottom of the pit, and all she can see is the light again, the same light again, that is this recurring theme. Another strange thing is that when you look at some of the characters who litter the landscape, Ned Pepper actually wears sort of these kind of pants, which are like fur, like goatskin pants. So he looks like a satyr. There's a man in a bear suit or satyr, would you say? How would you pronounce that? The Greek.
Yeah, I don't know.
But then there's this other thing where you've got the ferryman, where there's a, you know, where Maddie crosses the water, and then you've got a man dressed up in the bear suit, which is weird. Another thing that you'll find is that once they actually cross the river, sort of the river Styx, then you'll see that all of it's supposed to be in winter. You never really get the impression on the John Wayne one that it's winter. It always looks beautiful and sunny. But on this one, the 2010 one, it's got a sort of desaturated filming style. Once we cross the river, all of the trees are clearly in winter. They've got no leaves on them. So the land looks kind of dead and sterile. And then at the end, so she kind of has to come back. She has to get brought back out of the pit, out of hell. And it's Rooster that does that. So Rooster brings her out. And then to kind of nodding back to going through the Valley of Death, you see where it is literally a Valley of Death, because by that time Rooster shot the gang and he's galloping on the horse with her after to try to get her back to civilization. And it is literally a Valley of Shadow and Death. But you see on the end of it, far into the distance, it's light again, and all of the trees have, if they're conifers, so they're kind of, they've still got foliage on them, and he's heading back there. So it's as if Matty has been kind of lost her soul, and Rooster is going to take her back into civilization and redeem her, which is ultimately what he does. But that's why they ponder on the journey back. Is quite brutal, and it feels really epic. Like he just doesn't stop, and she goes into like a delirium, and she's crying because the horse cannot stand it. But Rooster just doesn't care. He rides the horse into the ground and then shoots it, and then he picks her up and he's running her back again. It's a really powerful scene. It's well done.
Like that's also in contrast to the 1969 one, because in that one, he rides the horse into the ground too, but then he just gets off the horse and starts running with her. In this one, he like it takes out his Bowie knife and then stabs the horse in the side to get it to keep running. Yeah. And then he shoots the horse. So they don't just leave the exhausted horse there. He actually takes out his revolver and shoots the horse. So, you know, and you just feel like that scene is pretty incredible, because you just feel tired as you watch it.
Yeah,
just when he gets outside of the, I guess, the medicine man's house, or I can't remember who that is exactly, but he just like fires his gun off in the air, and then he collapses in exhaustion, and then that's the last time that they ever actually see each other. So, yeah. You know, there's also the theme of like that he kind of became her father figure. In the 1969 version, you know, he rides off, and I think they even mentioned that one, that she's going to bury him in her family's cemetery. But, you know, she still has this father figure. No, the new figure in her life like that rides off triumphantly, and, you know, they're going to see each other again. Whereas in this one, you know, he became that father figure, but, you know, again, she loses him. She loses him like she lost her first one. And, you know, the end of the movie is not with any kind of like a reunion with him. It's moving him to it's moving his graveyard, where now she can just have his gravestone in her, and then in the family plot. And that's about it, though. That's about all that she has left of him.
Yeah, I mean, I see the people in the chat talking about Matt Damon. I agree that Matt Damon isn't much of an actor. He doesn't really have any range. But I do think he was good in this. I do think one of the things is, which is within his range, is being, if he's got a good director, just telling him, like, just, you remember the South Park thing when they did that Matt Damon thing? Like, he is like, he is just a potato. But I mean, he was playing LeBouf in this. And so he got, I think they did the whole dandy thing was played a lot better in the 2010 one. Especially the scene where Rooster's drunk and they're throwing up things in the air, and he cannot shoot for shit. And it's just the sort of the looks on Matt Damon's face is sort of rolling his eyes, and he knows that it's just a big disaster zone. It's very well done. I think the LeBouf character is actually better on the 2010 ones, because he looks like a bit of a dick. He looks like a real dandy. And another thing that he's doing is, like, Chaney's actually a bit of a moron. He's not the most intimidating. Lucky Ned Pepper is quite dangerous and intimidating. But Chaney, who's Josh Brolin in this one, he isn't. I mean, it's a surprising role for Josh Brolin as well, to be honest, because he is just a dumb loser. And obviously No Country for Old Men again. But Matt Damon's LeBouf is kind of laying it on really thick about how he's this really clever arch villain, and he's always one step ahead. Yeah. And he's really not, like.
Well, I mean that's another theme of the movie, is that we didn't get into, is that Chaney is not impressive villain. I mean, he's basically just this lowlife who goes from place to place, you know, and commits random crimes, and he basically just kills Maddie's father on impulse for no real reason, and then just kind of takes a couple of gold pieces. But that wasn't why he killed him. He just killed him because he was drunk. And then he's not the leader of the gang. The leader of the gang is Ned, and Chaney's just kind of like a low-ranking member of the gang. There's the good scene at the beginning where because you do kind of see that LeBouf is like, you know, like you said, I've never used the phrase "he's a dandy" before, but I see what you mean by that. There's a scene where Maddie wakes up and he's in the room, and he says, I've been hunting this guy for a while, and then she says, "How did you let him get away?" He's like, "Well, he's a crafty one." And then she says, "Well, I thought of himself as rather dim-witted myself." And LeBouf says, "Well, that was just his act." And she says, "Oh, it was a good act."
And he's going on all the time about how hardcore the Texas Rangers are.
Yeah, he mentions it so often in the movie about how the Ranger.
It's funny because they're sitting by the campfire, and he's like, down in Texas, like, we'd be happy if we just had a couple of twigs that would light for an hour, just so we could feel a little bit of warmth, because the policy is no fires, no, you don't give any signs. A rooster comes over, and he's got like a huge armful of big logs, and he just looks at him and drops it straight on the fire. Like, he doesn't care. He just wants to be warm. He doesn't want to hear all this bullshit. And Matt Damon just kind of looks away as if he's just been totally owned. Like, he doesn't want to hear any more bullshit stories about Texas. And I just think as a kind of sub-narrative, it works so well. It's really... really nicely done.
I mean, another difference is that in the 1969 one, LeBouf dies, but in the 2010 version, he lives. In the scene where Maddie gets stuck in the pit, Chaney had hit LeBouf over the head with a rock. In the 1969 version, that actually kills him, whereas in the 2010 version, he actually survives. Though, as she says at the end of the movie, that I haven't seen him. I never saw him since then. He'd be an old man now, but I wish I could see him again. So even like his character arc is a bit different too.
And he does save Rooster, though. He does pull off this, because all the way through the movie, he's been prattling on about what's the gun. I don't know anything about guns, like the Texas carbine or something.
Yeah, the Sharps carbine.
And he's been going on about how much of a brilliant shot he is. And we don't really think it's true. Because we're used to his flannel, but then when it really, really matters, he pulls it out and he drops this perfect shot, just drops like 400 yards. And Matty's again, like, Matty returns to little girl mode, and she's jumping around. She's all excited. And he's just about to say, he just starts saying where he's going to start talking about the technical aspects of the gun. And then he just gets like a big log just smacked across the back of his head. So even in his moment of triumph, yeah. You know, even in that moment, it's robbed from him. It's such a good stuff. It's really enjoyable.
I liked LaBeouf. I like the character in both the movies. I do agree that maybe Matt Damon's might have been a bit better. You know, he is a bit dopey, he's a bit self-righteous, but you know, he turns out to be a hero in the end as well.
Yeah. All right. So we've got a few super chats. So I want to say thank you very much for that. They've come in on the coffee pot as well. And I'm cutting in because, well, we're an hour and 25 minutes in, but there's also some good ones here, which will probably get a bit of discussion. So Phil bought me a beer and said, so this is good. I was saving this one. And he says, I love John Wayne, not just his movies, but the way he handled himself, IRL. The man was a true legend. Stalin ordered KGB to kill him. John kidnapped assassins as were targeting him, took them to a beach and staged a mock execution before handing them to the FBI. He also headed MAPI to try and...
Yeah, sorry.
What is that like?
Is he talking about you, Matt? Like
it's MPAPIE. I don't know what that is.
I think it's like the Council Against Anti-American Activity, yes, or something like that.
So he says he also headed that to try and stop the left in brackets from taking over Hollywood. Even in his death, he was legendary, constantly slipping in and out of comas, barely to talk to his daughter. And when she asked, do you even know who I am anymore? And he replied, of course I do. You're my girl and I loved you before slipping away forever. RIP legend. So I didn't actually know about that KGB story. It was literally just before we went live and I was doing a Google on it. And it's true. It turns out that that's true.
No, I hadn't heard of that. At least the story
that Stalin tried to get John Wayne killed by the KGB and he dodged it is true, it seems.
I also heard that even though Stalin didn't like John Wayne for political reasons, I heard that he was actually a huge fan of John Wayne's movies though, and he had like his own personal theater with all of Wayne's movies. So I guess he had a kind of a love-hate relationship with him. He loved his movies, but that's why he hated him politically.
Maybe. Well, I mean, to be fair, I mean, you could appreciate his films, but also understand why that was such a powerful icon for your enemies to have.
Definitely.
And you know, leading on to that, he did come up with all kinds of base stuff. Somebody on Twitter gave me a thing. I should have saved it, but I didn't. Where he basically said that the American Indians should just stop complaining. They were being selfish, and we were right to take the land. And he said it about black civil rights, similar things. There's one where he's old and he's sitting and he's bald, and he's surrounded by these kind of hippie students, and he's just kind of owning them all. He's just, you know, you're all pathetic. You don't know. You're all just moaning about nothing. You don't know what pain is. Amazingly, you know, True Grit, 1969. Imagine that is while that was coming out, while that was being made, like that was at the peak of the sort of cultural revolution in America. So, you know, you can look back on it now and you can see, like, I know which America I prefer, like what outcome, you know?
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, but unfortunately, It didn't turn out that way. But no, I have a lot of respect for the man. I mean, we also talked about him in the Clint Eastwood video we did, the one where we compared High Plains Drifter and Pale Rider, that John Wayne had heavily criticized Clint Eastwood for making the movie High Plains Drifter, because he thought it was like it was disrespectful to the American mythos, like the mythology of the American West. And you know, I don't think Clint Eastwood is a subversive figure. I don't think Clint Eastwood is particularly a subversive figure, but John Wayne did understand the importance of he understood the importance of mythos. Like another John Wayne story is that when Marlon Brando had this like Native American woman go on stage after he won an Oscar, he had this Native American woman go on stage to give some speech about how oppressed they were and you know, just like the typical like anti-white bullshit. John Wayne actually had to be physically restrained because he wanted to run on the stage and yank her off the stage. And well, you know, I know that John Wayne is, if he hasn't already been canceled, he's going to be. And by the modern day, by the establishment today. But I think though that he's going to be looked at in the future. He's going to be looked back on positively because a lot of the stuff he was right about, you know, John Wayne was right about the subversion in Hollywood. He was right about why you need to actually respect your nation's mythos. Why that's actually something that really matters. And you can't have people undermining it. And he also knew damn well that all this like anti-white stuff was, he clearly saw where all this was going to go. So, you know, I have a lot of respect for the guy. I know like today the left will probably show him as like the 50s straight white man oppressor. But, you know, I think, you know, once the winds change, and I'm confident that they will, and, you know, we return to a more state of sanity, I think John Wayne will be a man who's looked back on positively.
Yeah. I mean, for the people in the chat, we did actually do a whole classic movies on Pale Rider and High Plains Drifter, contrasting them. So you can see our take on that. It's there. I don't know. It's either on my channel or Endeavors. But yeah, we did that. We did the whole thing. Contrasted both movies, didn't we?
Yeah, it's on your channel.
It's on my channel. Most of those kinds of ones are. So you can check that one out to see what we think on that one. I'd just like to say, Adamantus in the chat says, Rooster in a way represents the pioneers and the girl and lawyer, what came after. Yeah, I think so as well. It's kind of innocently done, but it is there. It is there.
Yeah, we touched on that a bit. Yeah.
Okay, I just coughed there. I've got through the whole stream. And that was the first time I've coughed. Okay, so George bought 5 beers. Thank you very much. He says, I just hope I don't get debunked for this donation. No, I'm just a cultural commentator. Piers Taylor for $5. Thank you very much. Sergeant Steele, $5. Good afternoon, Morgoth. I hope all is well. Yeah, it is, except for this mysterious kind of cold flu thing I've got. X-ray Space 3033, $5. Yes, money. Thank you very much. And Jay bought 2 beers. Says, great film. Westerns are a huge part of cinematic history, and like some classic rock music, it seems their absence from pop culture is deliberate. Yeah, that's interesting because you get the odd one these days. They'll pop one out now and then, but the for whatever reason, the age of the Western is done with. And yeah, we did get through like pretty much all the stream without saying, fill your hands, you son of a bitch. But they can't actually do Westerns like this anymore just because it will be like against the policies of the studios to do them.
All the Westerns that are coming out today, they're all like terribly anti-white, and you know, it's not something. It's they still make some things in the genre, but it's all just like horrible propaganda, so you're not going to get something like this again.
I mean, I do what I do appreciate is one of the things we could do, I think, which would be interesting, would be to do a one where we look at Unforgiven and The Shootist, because they do. One of the great things about the Western lore is that it does kind of loosely connect up and complement. You see the same names and the same characters popping up, and sometimes they'll be in different roles. I mean, it's interesting that the John Wayne did one which had Billy the Kid in it, and oh god, I forgot the names now, but John Wayne was the landowner, I think it was, who Billy the Kid actually began working for.
Was that Pat Garrett and Billy the Kid?
No, that's a Sam Peckinpah one. This was a different take on Billy the Kid. But John Wayne was in that one, and Billy the Kid was a kind of side character in it. But then when you get into the 90s, I remember they did Young Guns, and there was this real kind of sort of glamorizing of the killers, It was like the Brat Pack, they called them at the time. Kiefer Sutherland and Emilio Estevez and Charlie Sheen and all of them. And it was just a completely different feel. It was much more nihilistic. But what they did do on that one was bring back James Coburn. And I think he had the role, Chisholm, that's it. Thanks, Travis. Chisholm, John Chisholm, yeah. And he was this, there's a few people pointing out Chisholm. Yeah, that's right, Chisholm. And it was him that was the sort of where Billy the Kid worked for him, and I think he got murdered. And I think John Wayne played him. And then Billy went off and did all. But in the Pat Garrett, I'm rambling and getting off all on all tangents. In the Sam Peckinpah one, which is one of my favorite movies of all time, Chisholm has a minor role, but he's played as a bit of a shitbag in it. Whereas obviously John Wayne just plays John Wayne like he does in all of his movies. But I think as time went on, they tended to glamorize somebody like Billy the Kid much more. You know, another recent Western was the Brad Pitt one with the Jesse James, when he was Jesse James. It had a really long title. But that's actually a nice movie as well. But again, it was a very, very sympathetic portrayal of the villain, which you wouldn't tend to see so much in some of the earlier ones. But I think that's a wrap. Have you got any parting shots on the world of True Grit?
No, I don't think I do. I just want to say that I think it's a good. I think the original version is good, and the 2010 version one is good as well. It just depends on what mood you're in. If you want to get into the mood of the present day, well, I think the 2010 one's the one to go with. If you want to escape the mood of the day and just have a good time and let your troubles go, then definitely go with the John Wayne one.
So. I mean, Clive of England, the chat says, are there any John Wayne statues in the US the Hateful Mutants would like to smash? I think where he's buried is a big John Wayne statue where he's buried. They probably will get wrong to that eventually. They probably will get wrong to that eventually. But that's a wrap. Thanks a lot, folks. Fill your hands, you sons of bitches. And what are you going to do next time? It's on your channel.
Well, I had two options. We could either go for some 80s nostalgia optimism with the movie The Untouchables, the Kevin Costner one, or we can get into some geopolitics with Black Hawk Down, the Ridley Scott movie. So I still haven't decided which one I want to do, but those are two different. Those ones I think will both be coming up in the future.
Black Hawk Down's the one where they crash in Somalia, and it's just I'm glad that one's on your channel.
a lot of interesting themes in that one, yeah.
I'm glad that'll be on your channel. I'll leave it up to you. Okay. I do have a bit of a hot take on the Untouchables as well. I'll just have a final check around. All right. So I think we'll leave that there. Classic movies. This is where your cozy Sunday starts. So I'll catch you later, folks. Thanks for tuning in, lads. See you later.